Welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. I am your host, Henrik Johansson. I am the CEO and one of the founders of Gemba. Gemba helps entrepreneurs and companies to turn their great ideas into awesome new consumer products. Please stay to the end of the podcast and you'll learn how you can be our next guest on Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. Let's do it. All right. Welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. And I'm super excited today to have a guest that I also am happy to call my friend, Kevin Brodwick. Kevin is the founder of many companies, and I hope we can talk about all of them today, but mostly we're going to focus on sort of his big first company, Think, the cover Think Baby, Think Sport, that he built over 15 years, I think, and then had a, you know, really nice exit at the end of it. And it's an exciting journey. I know a little bit of it, but look forward to really learn more about it today. So, Kevin, super excited to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. Looking forward to this as well.
Awesome. So before we dig into the business stuff and start talking about companies, why don't you give our audience a little bit of background on yourself? You know, where do you come from? How do you grow up? Where are you now? Family situation and stuff like that. Anything you're willing to share? Hope people get to know you a little bit.
Yeah. So prior to the company background, my family split time between Texas and Cape Cod. So my father was the head of neuro and cardiac for the University of Texas, but was a biophysicist, and that brought us out to Cape Cod. So as a kid, it was really half the year in Texas and half the year in Cape Cod, which you can imagine are very different worlds. But that also split my education. So the kids up in the East were always way ahead of where we were down in the South. So I'd get
all right.
The last few months, I'd be racing to try to figure out what exactly was going on there. And my mom was an epidemiologist. So I had a really strong scientific family, and that made for lots of interesting dinners. And one of the things that my father shared kind of later on is, you know, you used to play tennis with Sir Albert St. Georgie, who was the Nobel Prize winner for discovering vitamin C. To me, he was just an old guy that I played tennis with that tended to put a lot of spin on the ball. But we went back and forth there for about 15 years before really spending most of my early childhood in Galveston, Texas.
Wow, that's great.
And
do you recall having in-depth conversations about science and topics like that with your parents over dinner?
Oh, all the time. I mean, the table was complete characters of science. And as a kid, I always, tried to chime in, but what was being discussed was always way over my head. But it was pretty clear that the things that were being discussed would matter to consumers and people that were ingesting things, and they just didn't have, you know, good visibility to a lot of this science that was going on. And that always struck me as something that I wanted to be a conduit of at some point in my life, is how do you bridge this really hardcore science and make it consumable?
Wow. So you were thinking that as a teenager?
Yeah. This was, you know, again, the science was compelling. And just felt like, boy, there really need to be a way for people to understand it.
Right. But you weren't, so science and entrepreneurship are you know, sometimes related, but often not, right? When was the first time you started thinking about maybe starting something on your own?
So pretty early on, I knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. So both of my grandparents were actually inventors. So I had this sort of science on one side, but this inventor, you know, piece of the equation on the other. So I was really motivated to think about creating my own, you know, enterprise somewhere down the road. And somewhere in college, I started writing down my ideas into literally a little black book, which I still have today. And anything that came up as an idea, whether it was good or bad, whether it was putting, you know, parachutes on airplanes or, you know, making, you know, bathtubs that were fully digitized so that you knew exactly the right temperature, you know, as you were getting in. All these things made it into the book. And I had a really great professor at the University of Texas, Dr. Stephen Tomlinson, was a mentor to me during college and then after college. But during college, I went to him with this little book and said, you know, while everyone's racing out to go, you know, take this job or that job, my intent is to start my own company. And he looked at me and said, no way. And I was shocked. I thought really the response I was going to get, like, yeah, go for it. You clearly have some good ideas. But his feedback to me was, prior to launching your own company, you really need to understand how companies work. And it would be a good idea for you to go and work at every stage company, from a startup to mid-size to, you know, major, you know, large companies, because you need to understand also how they make decisions and how things happen. So I was pretty upset by his advice, but that's exactly what I went and did. So I was very specific in going out looking for, you know, every stage company. And Austin back, you know, in the early 90s was becoming the playground for tech. And so there was, you know, not much else going out, you know, going on in Austin outside of tech. So I kind of joined, you know, the ranks of everybody else in getting into that. And so I worked for, you know, companies that span, you know, Trilogy Software to, you know, Dell Computers. And so I did get a taste of like how things, you know, happened and who made decisions in corporations. That gave me enough confidence that I could eventually, you know, run my own enterprise.
Wow, that's great. And this whole time, it was very clear in the back of your mind that you were going to, this was a path, right? You were going to start.
This is a path. Yeah. Wow. I knew that I was sort of too cantankerous to actually work for other people. And so I needed to find a path where I got to, you know, stand up my own enterprise. And, you know, it wasn't like the first company I tried that I hit, you know, a home run. I started a small software company called Akido with two of my friends, Dr. David Moriarty and James Bonney. And the idea there was to create a kids browser that, you know, made sure that kids were going to, you know, the right places. And that got far enough that I actually was getting some emails from Mr. Rogers. So Fred Rogers and I were trading emails.
Oh, wow.
About getting him involved in the browser. And as that was going along, David came back and said, you know, I'm actually one of the best in the world at business AI. And this is in the early, early days of AI. Yeah. So we started working on building a company using his models to do business fraud detection. And wow. As we were taking off, and really I'm the front end of the company and he's all the brains in the back end, Apple Computers stepped in and took him completely off the plate. So all the intelligence and brain power basically walked out of that company. And he's now the head of intelligence for Apple Computers and has been for over 15 years.
Wow. Yeah. So. And what was this? Is like, is it early 90s, mid 90s?
Yeah. Into about 2000. And so I was still kind of dancing around the world of tech at that point.
Yeah. So what was the initiating, you know, what's the origin story of Think? So you're going from tech to something, you know, not necessarily tech, right? What happened and how did you come to that decision? Was there specific insight?
So for me, it came back to sort of the beginning of the equation, which was I really liked the idea of communicating science. And I wasn't getting a big educational or sort of fun rub from the tech side. So I felt like I had kind of lived that life already. And so I ended up all the way back full circle working for a lab that was funded by the National Institutes of Health on toxic chemicals. And so we were literally pulling products off the shelf and testing them to see if they were toxic. And then going to the companies to explain to them, hey, you have a problem, but this is not like smoking a cigarette, which there's not like a safer cigarette. There are alternative materials that are safer. And we received so much pushback from these organizations and companies, and we were very specifically looking at baby bottles that were leaching BPA or bisphenol A, endocrine disrupting chemicals. And so I said, hey, if the biggest companies in the world don't care about this, and this is a real problem, then I'm going to go stand up my own company. And so Think Baby and Think Sport started simultaneously, but that's where that origin story was.
Wow. So the organization you're working for, was that a nonprofit?
No, the lab was not a nonprofit. So it was funded by NIH to look at chemicals that were coming out.
Great. So the initial sort of origin insight was that there's not a good product here. There's a huge need for it. And it's
everywhere. This chemical and this issue is everywhere. And it doesn't matter what country is making the product, whether it is, you know, baby bottles or water bottles or even the fillings within people's, you know, dental caps and such. They're all filled with these chemicals. And we as humans interact with a wide class of chemicals that are largely unknown and have not been tested. So it's estimated that there's about 5,000 chemicals that behave just like BPA, which is pretty well known chemical now, that in your body today, there's at least, I think the average count is about 276 chemicals that are known to be harmful. Not to be a negative cast person, but this issue was rampant. And we were motivated to come in and begin tackling large areas, whether it was sports bottles or baby bottles or any kind of product that people interacted with down to sun care.
Wow. But to turn that negative into positive, like considering all the entrepreneurs that are listening, there may be all types of other chemicals like BPA that entrepreneurs could create a safer alternative for. Right.
Absolutely. And so when we first began looking at this, it was a broader class of chemical known as endocrine disruptors. And again, BPA was just one of those chemicals. And so in the science community, the conversation was, if we come to the world and start talking about biology, like endocrine disruption, we're going to get glazed over faces. So we need to get very specific on a specific chemical. People knew that mercury and lead, you know, asbestos and things like that were bad for you. So targeting a chemical like BPA made sense on how we would communicate it to the world. So we had, you know, launching the company, sort of a bifurcated problem. On the one hand, we're creating a product, but on the other hand, we have a big educational component that has to happen in order for people to understand why they're going to choose this bottle, you know, over another bottle. And then even another problem, which is you have a retailer like, you know, back then Babies R Us, which has millions of dollars of inventory of baby bottles. And so now how are they going to put a BPA-free baby bottle directly next to everything else that's in their lineup? You can't say, hey, this is safe and the rest of the stuff is crap and is going to kill you and create a myriad of problems for your child. And so that was a bit of, you know, early struggle.
So this was still early days, right? You've identified this massive opportunity. You're starting to outline some of the key challenges. Maybe stop for a minute and talk a little bit more of the product development process. What was the original product that you decided to bring to market? And can you talk a little bit about how you decided that was going to be the product and how you brought it into existence?
Yeah. So for us, the initial target was baby bottles. So we had enough data and knowledge that what was on the market was predominantly polycarbonate, which is made out of BPA. And so the target for us was clear, but then we had this issue of material science. So it wasn't just the physicality of the product that we had to solve for, but we also had to make sure that the plastic that we were using as an alternative was safe. And so there was not like a testing standard that we could go bank it off of to say, okay, now this is the safer one. We had to literally work with science labs and other testing agencies on various parts of the equation, but we were essentially creating our own standard, and it was far deeper and wider than any standard that existed, you know, on the planet. But going back, once we had, you know, this type of plastic, for example, that we felt was safe, we had to go back and find a manufacturer that would actually walk us through, you know, taking that plastic and putting it into form. So that was a struggle. So in understanding like who had the capabilities of, you know, building in mass, who had, you know, who was thoroughly certified. And so we searched the world, you know, to find partners that could solve for that. And we had kind of a process that we went through, whether it was baby bottles or sports bottles or any of the products that we worked with, which started with send us all of your, you know, certifications. So we wanted to vet out, make sure that whatever country that they were manufacturing in, that they had, you know, various levels of approval. Then we often would hire third parties to come in to do audits of the facility to make sure things like child labor and safe practices were happening. In some cases, some of our partners like Whole Foods went into one of our manufacturers to audit it to make sure that indeed it was everything we said it was. Sometimes that comes that direction. And then it became a sort of process of, you know, how do I build the shape and design of this widget? And I didn't have a team of people that was at the ready to design and sketch and CAD, you know, things. So I did this often just on my own, either on pieces of paper or napkins or, you know, in Illustrator, and would take those designs and send them, you know, to our partners and say, you know, please go, you know, build this form. I would also take not necessarily competitor products. It could be products that were similar and say, hey, I like these aspects of these products. Yeah. And I would tape them and send that overseas and say, let's capture these elements in the design aspect. But for the baby bottle, we had this idea that, you know, kids go from baby bottle to sippy cup to, you know, straw bottle. And my idea was, well, every time somebody buys a baby bottle, then that gets thrown away. And then they buy a sippy cup and then that gets thrown away. And then it becomes they get a straw bottle. Why not use the same core base of the bottle and just change basically the tops? And so we were the first transition system to go from, you know, 0 to 3 to 4 years of age. And also we found the kids didn't really like change. And so they were already used to the look of our products. So the transition from one to the next. So we had a little bit of forward thinking on that aspect of what we were solving for, but, you know,
and also reducing waste in the process, right?
That tremendous amount of waste, because the average parent has over 8 to 10 baby bottles. And then again, those disappear and get tossed. So there was a huge environmental impact. And also parents were saving a lot of money. They would just buy a different top, you know, to the bottle, and then they would get another year, you know, worth of use of the bottle. But all of that came down to what I would say is a lot of sweat equity being put in, because I didn't have like a big team or a bunch of experts to leverage on design. And so it was a lot of back and forth. That definitely.
Did you travel to overseas to visit
factories? To travel overseas. And there was a lot of back and forth. And actually some of the time they came to us too, which was great. But I would say that really elongated, you know, our process and our, you know, go to market, but I didn't know any better. And in Austin at that time, there were only a handful of consumer product companies. Like Yeti didn't even exist. And so there were just a few of us that were kind of, you know, trying to find our way. And I created a little group of like-minded companies, and we would meet for breakfast once a month and talk about, you know, our strategies and how to solve for everything down to getting the best rates at FedEx. So
that's great. So this whole phase of, you know, how long was this? 2, 3, 4 years or of you like working on that first product? Did you start selling during this time, or was it all sort of developing, testing? Or did you actually start also selling the product?
Yeah. So I have a, kind of a favorite slide when I'm giving talks. And the slide is just this giant number, $32.46. And I typically just let that fester for a while. It took me about a year and a half from concept to getting product out and available. And in that time, you know, I went through my complete life savings. So that number, $32.46, was my savings over my checking account total. There was no stock. There was no more 401k. I had like spent a bunch of money trying to get our first product out the door.
At the farm, you bet everything you had.
I did. I bet everything. I was sure that I was right. And we went out to, you know, some VCs, some big VCs in Austin to talk about, you know, doing a fundraise, and had sort of an interesting conversation there, which was one of the VCs said, you know, there are three reasons that somebody starts a company. Either they have a mission that they're on that they want to develop, or they're really interested in starting a company, or they just want to make a lot of money. And the group of VCs in the room all started laughing, like, hey, we just want to make a lot of money. And they had a huge, huge role about that. What I told them was I was on a mission, and that's the only level that I was really going to look up. I wasn't going to worry about, you know, the company, building a great company, or, you know, selling the company down the road, that we were going to stay very closely focused to our mission. But that if we did this, we might accidentally build a great company. And if we built a great company, then somebody might actually want to acquire it. But it had to be of the mindset, and our focus had to stay true to the initial message and mission, which is to build safe products. And, you know, there, I think we were really different than what, you know, back then there was a book, Inside the Tornado and Crossing the Chasm.
Yeah.
And it was like every entrepreneur sort of had to read those two books. And in that, it really sort of nails this notion of you go into a marketplace, you own that marketplace, and then you start to build other products. And we said, oh yeah, well, watch this. We're doing the exact opposite. So we really did something unique in that we went very wide. And so we did baby bottles and sports bottles and baby feeding sets and yoga mats and body care and sun care. And so while we were sort of the master of none of those verticals, what we became a master of was this credibility of being a safe products company. And that led me, you know, into sort of the product for us that became a bit of our hero, our sun care line. You know, at the end of it, I was the subject matter expert for sun care for Whole Foods, CVS, and Target. So they would come to us prior to going out to RFP for the next year's planogram to say, give us the true scope of what's going on in sun care. What ingredients, what's safe, you know, what are you hearing? So that level of credibility, though, really stemmed from the earliest days of a BPA-free, you know, baby bottle. But we definitely had, you know, there was a lot unknown. And
yeah,
I definitely would describe it as, if you can imagine a blank sheet of paper being your map of where you're about to land, and everything on that paper seems like it could be scary and out to get you. But once you start sort of carving out and moving around in that map, it starts to open up. You start to understand, oh, well, this is how I do this. And this is how I solve this problem. And, you know, certainly there are things that you're not expecting, you know, come out of the woods to get you. And we have had this shirt that we always wanted to make, which would say always something. And so in the world of CPG, you know, consumer products, there's always something there that's designed to kind of trip you up. Yeah. But things become less scary over time as, again, you continue to navigate.
That's awesome. So it sounds like, you know, heavy investment in developing the first product, but then it seemed like maybe it got a little easier. You learned a lot. You learned about the materials. You became a leader, an expert in how to create products of these materials. And then it was able to launch multiple products following that. Can you talk a little bit about the sales side of this? So we talked a lot about the product development side. How did you, after that first year and a half, you got a product. Did you, and this was before FBA, right? This was for Amazon. You could just post a product. You had to do it the old fashioned way, right?
Yeah, we really did. So for us, it started with, you know, participating in trade shows. And the first one for us was the ABC baby trade show. And you just can't believe how much baby stuff there is in the world until you walk into Vegas, you know, multiple floor, you know, scene of baby products. And we had the prototype at that point of the baby bottle completed. We literally ginned up the product packaging, you know, 3 or 4 days before sitting down at the trade show. And this is one of the things I highly recommend to entrepreneurs, which is figure out which of your friends knows stuff and then go ask them for help. And I was lucky. A gentleman named Jeff Williams, who was the creative director for Frog Design, is a close friend. And he helped not only design the packaging, but he helped design our logo. And so we show up at this trade show and we had pretty much instant, you know, retailers, you know, coming up and asking, even to the global head of Target walked up and was interested. We knew at that point we weren't big enough to go into a Target. And so our strategy was look for specialty stores first, build a strong foundation in specialty. For us, that was baby and sporting goods, and then begin walking up sort of the road to smaller chains, to mid-sized chains. And for us, a lot of what was going on was sort of specifically within the natural products, you know, sphere. So we were, you know, approaching natural markets. For us, we didn't want any single, you know, retailer to be the potential death of us. And so we had heard sort of horror stories about, you know, companies, you know, getting into Target early on. And we thought, well, why would that be scary? That seems great. And then it was pretty evident as we saw, you know, like really heavily VC backed, you know, companies go into Target and get spun right out. One, they hadn't built a big enough base of following to ensure that their sales, you know, were happening on the shelf. And two, you know, you get that first big PO from a major retailer and it's exciting, but then all of a sudden a lot of product is going out the door with a delayed payment on that product. And as soon as it starts to sell and you get that second purchase order, you have to have enough, you know, cash on hand to handle, you know, the second and third production orders. And that action actually trips up a lot of small companies. And so they get, you know, ambitious and excited about what that opportunity looks like without having the mechanism to sort of solve for it. And so, you know, we, you know, had gotten to the point of, you know, being in thousands of retailers before we started getting into, you know, mass size stores. And that was, again, by design. So we were really careful on how we grew it. However, we didn't, and this will be hard for some people probably to hear, but we didn't establish like really sales goals. So we came in pretty quickly, you know, getting to $1 million in sales, and we kind of hovered there for a couple of years before we started, you know, really scaling up from that number. But our attitude was, you can sit around and cogitate on building X model and Y model, and it felt like a lot of companies were wasting a lot of time when they could be getting feet on the street and going out and making sales happen. And so to your point, like Amazon wasn't, you know, it was emerging, but it wasn't what it is now. And we used, you know, very guerrilla style, you know, sales tactics, which included something that we dubbed the West Coast Tour, where my head of sales and I, we would get into a car in San Diego and load it with product and literally drive all the way to Vancouver. And so that trip often took us about a month. And so we were averaging 6 to 10 meetings a day. Oftentimes we're walking cold into retailers and showing them what we have. We did, you know, a decent job in getting some meetings in advance, but a lot of it was just cold. And so we basically would work to light up, you know, retailers along the coastline. And we did that trip every year, and we still do that trip actually with our newest companies.
I just love that story. I think it's so great. And, you know, particularly you and I have talked about this before, but it seems like there's so many entrepreneurs today that are looking for an easy path, and there's plenty of gurus that will tell them that they will teach them the easy path to, you know, build a multi-million-dollar business. And it's just not real, right? I mean, maybe it happens occasionally that somebody becomes an overnight success, but, you know, most of the folks I talk to, like you, it's more of a 15-year path, and it took a lot of sweat equity. And, you know, I just loved you telling that story about how you traveled up and down and walked into small retailers. You know, maybe they buy a couple of bottles, but you're still in there trying to get one more retailer, one more
customer. I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a baby retailer and had a meeting at a little mini, you know, baby, you know, little mini desk in the room, or somebody handing me their kid to hold for a moment. So that definitely was part of it, but it was great. I mean, all of that was huge adventure, down to like learning places to run and do yoga and what restaurants we were going to, you know, hit up. So it was a lot of work, and you definitely slept really well those nights. But yeah, I can't say enough about that type of activity being necessary. And you're right, there's very few companies that come out of left center that just hit a home run. It does happen, and they get, you know, a lot of, you know, visibility, but the most part, that's not how it happens. And I'm always super honest and transparent with entrepreneurs that it was 15 years of around the clock work. I mean, I woke up, I was on, you know, 5 in the morning. A lot of what I was doing was overseas. And so that would bring me, you know, straight to midnight. I worked a lot in the early days out of Starbucks on, you know, 5th and Lamar. That was kind of my location. And while people made fun of me for that a lot, it turned out that a lot of the execs at Whole Foods also would go down there and get their coffee in the morning. So I had a lot of impromptu meetings with Whole Foods just sitting there, which was great.
Yeah. And just one thing I just thought about, I mean, the amount of customer research that you got done by traveling and meeting all those customers in person and talking about them, that must have been incredibly valuable.
It was. And that's a really good point too. I think too often companies create too much distance between themselves and the customer. So we not only, you know, were interacting directly with retailers, we were often, you know, directly interacting with consumers on those visits too. So we would go into where our product was, and as people were there, we were fully branded, you know, with our Think Baby and Think Sport. And actually we wore medical scrubs that had our logo across it. And so we became pretty quickly visible and known as the guys that wear scrubs. And yeah, that brought a lot of credibility, because we walked in and, you know, it was laying down science. And sometimes in baby retailers, they would hold like mom groups that we would come in and speak to directly to give them insight into, you know, the world of safer products and steps that they could take. Our goal wasn't to scare people into buying products. It was to provide education and a view into what alternatives existed. But you're right, like too often you have the person selling a product is way too far away from the customer. And we didn't want to make that mistake. And I remember one instance, we were walking in Northern California into a restaurant. And again, we're wearing the Think Baby scrubs. And our sunscreen was really selling very rapidly, to the point where we were putting it on our website, you know, Tuesday at 3 o'clock, the next batch is coming in. And by, you know, 3:02, it was sold out.
Wow.
We had a mom cost us in a parking lot in near tears, because she was so desperate to get our sunscreen, didn't want to use any of the toxic stuff on our little one.
Yeah.
And you would think that we had just given her a winning lotto ticket when we handed her, you know, a couple tubes of our sunscreen that we had. But that sort of thing was like organically like happening to us a lot. And then as we began seeing our our product in various parts of the country, you know, we knew that we were doing the right thing to begin with, but we knew that it was catching on.
Yeah. And did you do that through the heavy sort of content marketing strategy, or was it more this in-person?
So we did a lot of in-person activities, and that included like speaking at like Safe, you know, product summits, but we also went straight to the media, and whether it was, you know, magazines or newspapers, to explain, you know, the issue of toxic chemicals coming from consumer products. And those stories were getting picked up by, you know, Washington Post to, you know, Wall Street Journal to just about finally every major, you know, magazine in the country was covering us. In fact, I wrote a piece and submitted it to Men's Journal just to give them some insight into sunscreen and how consumers should think about what SPF, you know, means in broad spectrum. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden there was a 2-page write-up in Men's Journal about sunscreen. It was basically what we had written.
Wow.
And then, you know, we had all of a sudden somebody's calling me and saying, "Hey, Drew Barrymore is talking about your sunscreen on her feed." I'm like, wow, that's cool. And then Martha Stewart's folks reached out to us and said, "Hey, Martha is heading on a trip to Antarctica and the Arctic, and she'll only use your sunscreen. We need it right away. Can you overnight it?" Yeah, no problem. The National Geographic team was heading up to Everest and wanted, you know, to cover our sunscreen. And yeah, that was also a no-brainer. So we were very organically, you know, getting coverage. And I think that sort of thing does happen when you're aligned to movements that are doing better for the world and better for consumers. So we had some, well, we were doing a lot of work doing storytelling. There was a natural organic pickup of our products. And so it was rare that there was a top 10 list of the best sunscreens or the best baby bottles that, you know, we weren't part of. And then it got to the point where, you know, Amazon's PR team took it on a roadshow and began, you know, pushing it. And that's how part of the reason our sunscreen grew so fast on Amazon as well.
That's amazing. How much of that was deliberate? I mean, you started very mission driven. I love the fact that you didn't have sales goals. You'd like let the business grow at the right pace for the business rather than forcing it into something. I mean, I see that all the time. Like you said, people trying to hit arbitrary sales goals and, you know, chase growth at any cost, and it's never healthy for a business. But it sounds like you really cracked the formula of building a brand through content and community. Was that, did you have very clear metrics around that, or was it more of an organic?
Yeah, we really didn't have like a clear path. We knew that any opportunity that we had to tell our story, we were going to take that. And again, it came down to us being super focused on the mission. And really the adage that if we keep this up, that even if at the end of the day we weren't bought by, you know, acquired by a third party, but if we were able to move the whole industry away from toxic chemicals, then we still win. So that for us was still a checkbox. Hey, good job. You changed the world. Yeah. And now go do something else. Or But we didn't have like, okay, today we're going to spend 20 minutes on talking to magazines and then 30 minutes. It wasn't like that. Yeah. We were just excited to tell our story. And I'm probably overdoing it now.
I know. It's perfect. But you're right. We probably have to wrap. So now we are, let's fast forward towards the exit then. So you built this awesome brand. You have Martha Stewart, Drew Barrymore, other people are using it. Everybody's talking about it. Mom's costing you a parking lot, right? It's success by any measure. And I don't know exactly what your revenue numbers were, but they must have been growing at a very, very healthy pace. At what time do you start thinking about selling the business here?
So we had gotten to a point where we were in about 25,000 locations in North America. We knew that we were in the top two or three in the category of natural sunscreen. In most cases, we were number one, whether it was like Whole Foods or Babies R Us. We had gotten to the number two fastest selling baby sunscreen in China, which was great. And so our footprint was big enough, our story was compelling enough that we started to entertain the idea that, you know, and we were fielding incoming requests. I guess that's the other piece of this, is that people were actively showing interest in, you know, acquiring us. And so we began taking some steps that were fairly complicated for us because we weren't built, you know, for sale. And we'd grown the company largely on QuickBooks, which I don't suggest. I mean, as an initial step off point, that's fine. But when you get to enterprise level, we were crashing our QuickBooks instance, you know, regularly. It was just too much data in it. So we had stepped into a really big, you know, migration from QuickBooks to NetSuite.
Ouch.
And that actually all unfolded as we were going through the acquisition process. And so if you can imagine the level of data inquiries that are coming in from, you know, the acquirer, and you're busy, you know, trying to build everything into NetSuite. So our attitude was, hey, we'll go down this road. But also, if it doesn't happen, we're not stopping what we're doing. We're growing too fast. So yeah, the whole NetSuite piece took us almost a year and about six figures to complete.
Yeah.
But, you know, we ran what I would say a pretty traditional process. And so we started with, you know, looking at, you know, who's our investment banker going to be. And so we did a bunch of outreach and had a bunch of IB teams show up at our office and do, you know, kind of their dog and pony show and take us to dinners and understand, you know, how they looked at us as a company and how they would run, you know, the process. And ultimately we chose Houlihan Lokey, and the person there was Susan Roddy. And they did a great job in helping us build out what's called your SIM, which is your management presentation deck, sort of end-to-end story with analytics and your numbers. And then took that out on a roadshow, which ultimately ended up with myself and our team in New York and having a group of private equity firms and strategics come in. Hear our story directly. So it was a nice condensed process from that perspective. We weren't traveling, you know, from coast to coast type of thing, from meeting to meeting.
Yeah.
But I also had my cousin, Jason Spivak, is a big M&A guy, teaches M&A at University of California in Santa Barbara, and has had a dozen super successful companies and IPO'd, you know, a few of them. So he stepped in kind of over my shoulder and said, you know, here's the things that you need to look for. And oh, by the way, here's my M&A accounting firm and my M&A, you know, legal team. So having, you know, a team that was used to doing billion-dollar ideas sitting over my shoulder because of him was, you know, a huge benefit. But you want to have, you know, your complete set of teams and all of the audit, you know, work done and your like virtual data room, you know, nice and complete prior to stepping into, you know, that process. And then for us, ultimately, we didn't select the highest number that came through. We went down, I guess, one level because we felt like the acquiring entity was going to keep the brand intact. And that was really important to us, that the brand didn't get diluted or that, you know, product suddenly was not being, you know, made safe. And so that was one of the things that had to happen. And so New Mountain Capital acquired us and then basically tucked us into Topix Pharmaceutical, which they owned, which was sort of an umbrella manufacturing organization that had very similar philosophies on building, you know, safe, better for you products. Oh, yeah. And yeah, they still adhere to all of that. They still ask questions. And it's still, for example, the only products that I'm willing to buy off the shelf. You know, it's a little strange to buy the products that you built. But
yeah. Anything you're willing to share about sort of what ballpark revenues, ballpark exit valuation? And if not, that's totally fine too. But
Yeah, I don't know that they would love for me to share that,
cool.
but you know, into the realm of, you know, 4x, you know, multiplier on revenue is what was sort of happening in the time of, of February of 2020. You know, things got a little weird for a moment with the pandemic, you know, hitting, but then I know valuations continued to scale from there. I think now things have calmed down, you know, a little bit. We were, you know, positive EBITDA positive to 30% almost straight across from day one. So we held this without doing modeling. That was a crazy outcome, but it, I mean, it literally just kind of held to this 30%, you know, number. So we were really careful in how we built and stayed, you know, lean. I will share that the total investment that I pulled in, you know, was $750,000. And so to go from that amount to the amount we were doing in the tens of millions of dollars in sales is only because we were willing to roll up our sleeves and sweat equity like crazy.
And as a result, presumably you owned a very large share of the company at the end.
I did. And my dad once said to me, he said, hey, you can own 100% of zero, or you can give away, you know, some. And I tried to own most of the company. And that I think per industry is different. So like in the beverage world, a lot of those entrepreneurs have much smaller stakes at the end of the race. In health and beauty, that number tends to be a bit higher with entrepreneurs holding, you know, majority stakes in their business. And that was the case for us too.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. Congrats on the success story. Very well deserved. Would you mind spending a couple minutes on what you're working on now? It sounds like you exited. You may still be a little involved, but this is not your day job anymore and hasn't been for a few years. What's next?
Yeah, so I really thought I was done. And I realized, though, that, you know, a lot of people that are in consumer products tend to say that they're done, and then the next moment they have some, you know, new venture. You know, Clayton Christopher, who did Sweet Leaf Tea in Waterloo, and then on and on and on, is definitely the kingpin of launching consumer brands. And yeah, while I thought I was done, one of the things that we were working on that we carved off in the sale of Think was the idea of doing bar shampoo and creating waterless, sustainable beauty. And I think I have brought, just in case, we have started a company called Brixy, which is a shampoo, conditioner, body wash line. And again, there's no water. Every bar is equivalent to 3 bottles of shampoo. So it's a big displacement of shampoo, of plastic. And the product works. I mean, obviously, I'm not the right spokesperson for the company. So I hired my right-hand guy that was with me at Think, Trey Vilko, to run Brixy, and plucked my wife out of tech. She was managing a big team in a Fortune 1000 software company. So they're leading the charge, and I kind of work in the background on product development and then kind of pointing, oh, don't do that, do this. So I'm a bit of a backseat driver. So that's, you know, taking a bunch of time, and we're in about 2,500 stores now in Whole Foods, Sprouts nationwide. So a lot of what we knew before, we've cut in and pasted into this, and still adhering to our focus on making safe, better for you products. And we have a bunch of new products that are being launched actually next week, even. And then probably the strangest thing that's happened to me in business, somewhere in the early days of Think, a friend of mine was asking me about starting a beer beverage company. And so he spent about a month asking me questions. And somewhere along those lines, I had a dream about a beverage brand. And anybody that started a company will tell you one of the first hardest things is coming up with a name of a company. Everything is taken, every angle. And I dreamt a brand at the label down to the name. And at around 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and said, wow, this is a crazy gift. And I drew it. And so my next venture is called Atomico. And this is a rendition of what I drew at 3 o'clock in the morning, but a little clearer to read. And basically, better for you, vitamin infused sparkling water, you know, 12 essential vitamins at 20%. And that's the sort of front end is this idea of this character, Atomico, who is a space traveler who often, you know, finds that he's created, not he, but he's created a some type of catastrophe and doesn't really realize it. But as the storytelling of the adventures of Atomico go along, what the recipient is actually getting is fun, interesting ways to learn about astronomy and astrophysics. So we right now are pushing a lot of education. We formed a partnership with NASA to create a scholarship fund to send kids to space camp, and we'll also be funding STEM programs. So it's a, you know, organic and natural beverage with no calories, but it's also a learning education system that we're working on. So those two things are taking my time on the work side of the equation.
That's beautiful. And what a perfect way to kind of tie end the loop here, starting at the dinner table with your parents talking about how to bring science and consumer products together. And, you know, after Think, you're now working on these exciting and new initiatives. So if people want to learn more about Brixie or Atomico, where should they go?
Yeah, so it's just gobrixie.com or goatomico.com. So both of those sites are up and operational. And yeah, we're having a bunch of fun. That's what's maybe a little bit different this time around is we have a little bit more knowledge of how to navigate that map. And yeah, we're just going to stay true to our mission just like before. That's our goal.
That's awesome. So thank you so much for being on the podcast. Before we wrap, any final words of wisdom you would want to leave with entrepreneurs who are listening and are thinking about this journey or in the midst of the journey?
Yeah, I would say a good idea to surround yourself with positive people. So as I mentioned before, there's the shirt that we want to create that there's always something. It's a very difficult journey. It's rewarding like nothing else I've ever experienced, no question. But it's really important to surround yourself with people that are going to be a positive part of that equation, because there are so many gotchas, you know, along the way. Like all of a sudden, you know, the port in Oakland is on protest and they're not going to let your container, you know, into the US, or, you know, the largest baby retailer in the world suddenly collapses and they owe you a tremendous amount of money. There are these things, these moments that you sort of hit the wall, and it's kind of in that moment that makes or breaks entrepreneurs and how you know, navigate getting around that wall. And it helps to have, you know, folks that are positive pieces of that equation. And that includes, you know, right down to your team, that everyone is focused on a similar mission and that you've created, you know, the right working atmosphere, you know, to be able to obtain that. And I guess the last thing, I don't know where I heard this quote, but if you have a hunch, bet a bunch.
But I love that.
If your hunch is wrong, your bunch is gone. And so there's a dose of reality of also knowing where that line is of, hey, this is not working. And it's not to be negative, but when you step into something, you should also consider, where is the line that says, all right, this isn't going where I need it to go. It's not that you're going to quickly throw your hat in the ring, but it is knowing when to step out. That's also important. And I think that was a little bit true of in selling the company too. There, I knew that I was going to grow the company to a certain size, and then it would be better to have people that were more operationally focused. Yeah. You know, oftentimes you hear entrepreneurs are actually a problem within, you know, an organization at some point. They're always pushing the envelope and always trying to add, you know, new things. And so it's important to also know when to get out of the way of your own, you know, creation.
That's great advice. Kevin, thank you so much for spending time with me. I really appreciate the journey and congrats on all the success. It's truly, truly deserved, and look forward to what's next, and best of luck in the new endeavors.
Yeah, thank you. And likewise, we're excited to watch what you got going on too. So it would have saved us a lot of headache. I probably would have had more hair.
I love it. All right. Thanks, Kevin. That's it for this episode of Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. All righty. This is Henrik Johansson again. Thank you so much for listening to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. If you are a successful product entrepreneur or you work in a company that creates new products and you have an interesting story about how you developed your product and brought it to market, and you would like to be on this podcast, please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast, and you can fill out an application to be on the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you liked this podcast, if you enjoyed this interview, and we would greatly appreciate if you would share it on social media. You can just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on socials. If you know anyone that you think would be a great guest, please tag them on social media and let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovator Insights. And would love to see your posts and any suggestions you have to guests. That's how we find most of our guests, from suggestion from other listeners. We're regularly putting out new episodes and new content to make sure you don't miss any episode. Please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show and me and the team. We really appreciate it. Do you want to know more about Gemba, me, or the podcast? Please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast, or you can follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I do most of my posts. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Have a great day.